I'm going to wrap the three topics together that they wanted me to address. This: how do you bring soil health, climate variability, and global food security all together? And I'm going to do this in less than 20 minutes in terms of this process, because it is about bringing the pieces together. I have some co-authors in here. I have two really good postdocs who have been working on this in a number of different ways. One is just really how do aggregates form, how do they change within soils, how do we look at the carbon balance within soils, and I'll show some of those pieces as we go along. And then Tom Sauer is one of my cohorts in crime in terms of looking at this. And Tom has actually been sampling soils under tree systems as well as ag systems, so we look at what happens to the landscape as we change it as well. Oops. So let's start with soil functions, and then let's build this all up, because I think if we want to start looking at food, energy, and water security, is that first we've got to look at the soil properties that are out there, and there are a plethora of those. We can go all the way from organic carbon to pH, all the things that producers measure, but then start thinking about how those integrate into soil functions in terms of whether they're food production or biological diversity, carbon sequestration, availability of water, nutrients, and then you bring that up to another level and you put that into the context of ecosystem services, whether there's provisioning, regulating, cultural supporting. And then you get up to this final nexus that everybody talks about in terms of food, energy, and water security. But in reality, when you read all the papers on food, energy, and water security, they lack one critical component. Because no one of those papers ever talks about soil. You know, that magically appears in terms of this process. And so we have written an article, it's in Advances in Agronomy, on soil, the forgotten piece of this nexus. Because if we really want to think about the dynamics as we go forward, soil has got to be much considered in a much different way than what we've been talking about in the past. So we put these together in soil functions. First, I'm going to degrade soil. I'm going to break it down in all of this, and we can start by what I call the soil degradation spiral. Anything that's up there in terms of poor land management, and the first thing that changes in that soil is the aggregation stability. The stability of the aggregates, they come and they go very quickly, and they're coming and going right at the surface. One of the things you see is then you see crusting, you see compaction, because that soil is no longer stable. You end up with water and wind erosion. We start eroding that soil. We begin to reduce plant growth because it's just not supporting at that level. If you're not growing plants in there, you're not putting exudates back into that, so you change the whole soil biology. Yield disappears, and then finally you've got reduced soil productivity. If you look at this upper part of this where we get aggregate stability and aggregate degradation, is that it becomes very susceptible to the extremes of precipitation, all the events that I'll show you as we are changing. And as we get farther down in this whole reduced soil productivity, you're getting the negative responses to weather variation. The soil starting showing a lot more variation among within parts of the field, across fields, a number of different things that occur in that. And so we really need to understand that soil aggregation really is a fundamental problem. And soil degradation is one of the critical issues that we face in terms of looking at this system as we go forward. Just going back in there, if you look at Poston's data and synthesis from 1997, 20 years ago, is that, you know, we have to realize that we've continued to degrade the organic matter in our soils. If you look at Missouri, and this is the long-term plots, the Morrill plots and the Sanborn plots, Sanborn plots disappeared very quickly. They've leveled off. The Morrill plots have been on a slow decline. Our own analysis with 15 years of flux data over a corn and soybean system is that when we compute those carbon fluxes every year continually and across years, is that we lose 1,000 pounds of carbon per year in a typical corn soybean system. and we've verified that both with the flux measurements as well as with the soil measurements. So we need to realize that we continue to take our carbon and put it into the atmosphere, and when we're taking that carbon out, we're beginning to also look at where we take and make that soil more fragile, make it more susceptible as we go back to this degradation. If we look at soil systems, and you look at an aggregate stability to the surface, why this becomes important: if you have a soil with low biological activity, as soon as that soil is subjected to a rainfall event, those aggregates are unstable. They begin to disappear rather quickly. They clog up those pores at the surface. We end up with low infiltration rates. It's not uncommon across the Midwest to see infiltration rates less than 0.5 inches per hour. We can see runoff out of fields with less than 0.5 inches to 1 inch in a gentle rain. We get these more stable soils with high biological activity in them. Aggregates are much more stable. They absorb that rainfall. The aggregates stay there. We get infiltration rates that are somewhere between 2 to 4 inches per hour. And so we need to realize that as we look at this system, the governing piece of this is often the 0.5 inch of soil at the surface, because that is the gateway to water, that is the gateway to oxygen, and CO2 exchanges back and forth. So when we talk about stability of soil systems, we talk about all the things that go on in soil health and everything else, is we need to realize that sometimes we have to stratify it differently than what we've been doing. That we're really stratifying it, looking at what that gateway is for water and air exchange back and forth. And that's that skin of the soil. It's not the upper 6 inches, it's the upper 0.5 inch when we look at this piece of the puzzle. We've looked at a lot of this. We have some pretty interesting experiments going on. You go back to this one here. We just finished collecting 4 fields at 50 meter grids to 1.2 meters. We've divided them all into 15 centimeter segments and separated every 15 centimeter segments into 7 different size fractions. And then we've rained on all those size fractions to look at aggregate stability. So these cover landscape positions, they cover rotations, they cover a number of different things that go with that that allows us to develop this. We've also been looking at this. We actually have taken and begin to look at what does tillage do, what does residue removal do, what does that impact on infiltration rates, what's the impact on gas exchange rates. We have a series of cores that are 18 inches in diameter by 30 inches, and they're all instrumented with temperature, water, CO2, and oxygen fluxes. And these are measured continuously. So we can look at this exchange of CO2 in there. We begin to see the dynamics of what we begin to change within that and how that responds, as well as the biological activity. We're going to have to get down to the very, very heart of some of these things to understand the signals that Nick's picking out of the Soil Health Partnership. And it's going to take some complex experiments to do that. But if we want to build soil back up, we have to realize that there is a process. That spiral that we degrade soil is a fairly slippery slope in all of this. To build soil back up is much more of a ladder. It's much more of a climb, but we have to realize that in order to build soil back up, you have to start with how we stabilize that microclimate to allow the soil biology to have a home in which it can work effectively. And so soil biology wants 4 things. It wants water, food, air, and shelter. What do you want? Water, food, air, and shelter. The same thing that you want is what the biology wants. And we have to stabilize that microclimate in there. One of the things that we've seen as we look across agricultural systems in the Midwest, when we have conventional tillage and everything, that soil surface temperature in the early part of the season will be at 60 degrees centigrade at the soil surface. At 2 inches, it'll be plus 100. And we denature proteins at 104. Basically, what I'm telling you is in a lot of our current agricultural systems is we cook the biology out of the soil surface. And we expect it to do something. And it cannot operate in that microclimate. We've got to put some level of cover on it, to reduce the variation in temperature, reduce the variation in moisture content, so it has that stable home. And then you can feed it in all of this. And so we see this aspect going on, so we have to have the biological activity. Once we get that, we see the organic matter turnover, we see the improved nutrient cycling, which are the invisible and dynamic processes that are going on. And then we finally get into the visible processes. The visible things are the improved soil structure, the improved water availability, the number of different things, the improved infiltration rate, things that we see visually, but there are a lot of things that occur dynamically within that before you see that. And so we have to look at this as a ladder, how we build it up, how do we change it. Not all soils respond the same in this across fields. Why this becomes important is how we're going to handle the climate variation that's occurring. We're going to see trends in temperature. We're going to see trends in precipitation that says soil is going to become even more important of how we think about this. Temperature changes across the U.S. It's getting warmer in the upper Midwest. It's getting warmer in the Southwest. The Southeast is actually cooling a little bit. And that's the standard climate trends that we go through. Our growing seasons are longer. It says that we can do more things with crops as we go along. Look at the plant hardiness zone map. We've kicked it north in terms of hardiness zones. So we have 9 more days in the upper Midwest in which we have the capability of growing things. May add to our crop diversity, may add to that issue that Terry just raised in terms of looking at the diversity of crops that we can grow and how we can diversify that system both from a cover crop perspective as well as everything else. Maximum temperatures across the Midwest have actually been going down. Minimum temperatures have actually been going up. Our temperature rise is not because we're raising both parts of it, it's because we're raising the minimum temperatures. That has all sorts of implications for plant growth, a number of different things, but it has all sorts of implications for soil temperature. And in climate, we always talk about air, we never talk about soil temperatures. And so the soil temperatures are going to rise, that means that there's going to be a lot more activity within that soil, a lot faster nutrient cycling, a lot of faster organic matter cycling, all those different things that go with that. And we're also going to see more extremes. And so these extremes of temperature, particularly in the late summer, are going to get larger and larger. So if we want our ag systems to respond profitably and effectively, we have to realize that they're going to be hammered a little bit in this. It's Corn Belt's getting warmer. It's occurring at different ways and different times during the year. It's warming in the cold season as well. Winters are getting warmer. And minimums during the summer are basically driving most of our warming from that standpoint. Precipitation, this really becomes the more important part of this, is that we are getting wetter across the, basically the Corn Belt, all those I states are getting warmer or wetter, extends down into the Mississippi River Valley. Southwest is drying. California is still getting wetter, although the last 5 years of drought sort of dropped that back down a little bit. But you look at all of this, but here's really where it becomes more important for precipitation. Is our trends in precipitation are showing much more of a signal towards heavy precipitation events. Climatologically, heavy precipitation events are more than 1.25 inches per day. I know a lot of you would say, well, that's not heavy. But in reality, from a climatological perspective, that's a heavy precipitation. And so we can see more and more events. The upper Midwest is seeing our events occur in big rainfall events. The Northeast is actually showing much larger trends in this, and that's why we see a lot of flash flooding in the Northeast and a number of different things because of the impervious surfaces as well. We're also seeing shifts in seasonality of precipitation. We're getting wetter. This happens to be Iowa. We're getting wetter, but we're also getting more of that rainfall that's occurring in the spring. So we're shifting our rainfall pattern, and in generality across the Midwest, is that we're getting wetter, we have more in the spring, and more variable during the summer, and a little bit wetter in the fall. You just see this when you look at variability maps. It says that unless we're protecting our soil during the spring, we're going to see more and more of those events that are in that upper right-hand corner, and we'll see a lot of the events that are in that lower right-hand corner with drought that occurs, much as we had across the Midwest a lot this summer as well. What also important is that this combination between spring and summer, reflected by May, June precipitation versus July, August, is the last few years are representing anything outside of what we've seen since 1895. And producers realize that the weather is getting weirder, and they're trying to figure out how to manage around it. Long-term projections, if we take it on out in our current trends outward, winters are getting wetter, springs are going to get a lot wetter, summers are going to get drier, and falls are going to get wetter. And so says that if we're going to manage this system, and soils is the water component of that, and how we get water into that soil and store water into that soil is going to be very, very critical. So this link between soil health and productivity, if we want to move towards that goal of sustainable intensification, how do we get more out of each piece of land? Says that we need to understand the relationship between soil health and productivity. What does that mean on a field basis? What's it mean on a regional basis? How do these pieces begin to fit together? And I'll just use this as an example. This is a available water holding capacity within one production field that we work in. What we actually have this highly instrumented with flux towers and everything else to look at the carbon fluxes. The unique thing about this field compared to our other conventional field is that this is a cover crop no-till field. And after the first year, we already begin to see deviations in that carbon budget between conventional systems and the cover crop no-till system. And so we sampled this field at 50 meter grids last fall. We're sampling it again with a piece this fall as well to see what's occurred over 1 year in terms of some of these dynamics. We got to put it in the context of what I call the G by E by M, the genetics by environment by management interaction. Think about it this way. Management is what a producer oversees. The environment's what they're overcoming because genetics is what they're optimizing. And so when we start looking at this, soils become a critical component of that because this becomes the linkage of food security, is that we have all of these things around the side that are somewhat related to soil health. You've got water availability, we've got infiltration, aggregate stability, nutrient cycling, organic matter, cation exchange, all those things leading to food production. How do we make it all work in this is a complex puzzle. Nick is going to have to go much beyond a three-dimensional diagram to be able to understand these linkages. But soil health, climate variation, food security, the foundation to being able to reduce our climate variation is going to be through this whole process of soil aggradation. How do we build that soil up? How do we improve the quality of that soil? That's how we ensure food security as we go forward, because soil becomes the nexus of how we connect those three things in that component. We need to understand that, and we need to understand what soils do and all those different processes. So with that, I'll entertain some questions.
Wow. You're on time. Thank you. Any questions for Jerry? We have time for a few questions.
Yes, sir.
With the changes that we're seeing in precipitation patterns getting less frequent, more intense rainfall, what do you think are some management practices that we can try to do to promote soil health in the Midwest region?
First, practices that we've got to do to promote soil health with all this intense precipitation, get that water into the soil. First is that we've got to protect that soil surface. We've got to have that residue layer on there, because what we see with these intense rainfall events is that we've got a bare soil surface, the instability of that, those aggregates, we just puddle out very quickly. And so if we can protect that and absorb that raindrop energy by residues, particularly in the early season, then we can get that water into the soil. As I tell producers, it's not how much rain you get in a rain gauge, it's how much rain you get in the soil. And so it's really that piece of that. I use a very simple definition of soil health, and I tell farmers to go out in their field and look after a 2-inch heavy rain and tell me what the surface looks like. Because if you've got little rivulets and you've got runoff going in between rows and everything, you don't have soil health. Because if you can't take a 2-inch rain into your soil, then you need to be thinking about processes that improve that.
What is your take on the producer's overall opinion of soil health? Do they adopt it readily? Do they know what the definition of soil health is? Or what's your...
That's an interesting question. How do producers perceive soil health? They realize that one of the things, and when you start looking at yield variation across fields, and that's why I think some of the data that Nick has is so valuable, because it's not at an aggregate field level. It is at a very granular level within the field. And you begin to show producers that this part of the field is variable in yield. It has low yielding parts. Generally find that that has low yield water holding capacity, low nitrogen cycling capacity, and that has been degraded over time. That if you want to improve that soil, you can see an improvement in yield stability across that field, a number of different things that go with that. So inherently they know, but they often say, well, what's the path to get there? And it's really the path to in getting this. I mean, a lot of the producers that have been farming their own fields for a long time say, you know, this field has gotten more variable in terms of yield. Because they know when they go through the combine, here's the high-yielding part of the field, here's the low-yielding. They didn't have a yield monitor 20, 30 years ago, but they know that, why is this part behaving differently? And what can I do about it? And we've worked with producers where we've put improved their soils and everything else. We've taken their yield variation down to less than 20 bushels on half-mile rows and everything. So I look at that as a pretty good testimony that we can do things quickly within that. But they're interested in it, and how to, because it's money. You know, it basically, it's how do we convert what we're doing into cash and profit as well.
All right. Thank you very much, yeah. Jerry.